Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with the Gaia app, available through the App Store or Google Play. This will give you access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a three-month plan and an annual plan. You'll have access to incredible shows only available on Gaia, like Truth Hunter, Buzzsaw, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief, Missing Links, Hidden Origins, and my favorite, Deep Space. Gaia is available on your Android or iPhone, Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire TV. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, folks. GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Hey, what is going on, everybody? Thanks again for joining us here on, that's right, Expanded Perspectives. It's been a little bit of a battle today. Things have been going a little rough, but we've made it through, and that's all to the help of my bread sitting across the table, Mr. Filio Kyle Filson. Hey, bread, thank you so much for enlightening me on the fluidity of your profanity earlier today.
Oh, man, I'm telling you what, We've dodged the bullet, I guess, for a long time. I mean, we've been doing this show for almost 4 years, doing the show twice a week for the regular show and the elite show. And we've never really had this happen.
No catastrophe like this.
You know, here I've talked to many other of my podcasting friends from all over the world, and this has always happened to at least almost every one of them at least once. It's never happened to us, but we've been able to dodge the bullet. Now, this wasn't anything that was on me, so thank God I couldn't get blamed for it. But we were doing an interview.
I tried.
with Seth Breedlove, you know, who just did this amazing movie about the Mothman. And halfway through the interview, my digital audio recorder started giving me some weird messages that I've never seen before. It had like spinning gears on it, and it was prompting me. And I'm like, what is this? So I stopped the recording while Cam was talking. Never even told him. Started it again and just crossed my fingers and say, hey, I don't know what that was. Let's hope for the best. When the interview was over, I went back and listened the whole first half of that. The file was corrupted or something. I don't know what happened. I still don't know what happened. Also, while talking to Seth, the Skype connection, not the connection went out. All of a sudden, we just couldn't hear him anymore. I mean, he couldn't hear us.
He couldn't hear us.
Vice versa. We were talking. I was like, okay, well, let's hang up and recall him. Did that. Nothing.
Then the computer freezes.
The computer totally locked up.
Yeah.
Rebooted that. So long story short, for whatever reason, I don't know, because of the subject matter, if we were talking about the Mothman or Injured Cold is in here outside right. The studio, but everything that was digital that we were using to record the show all of a sudden started going haywire, started going on the fritz. We had gremlins in the studio, or Hadels, as Micah Hanks calls them.
Right.
I don't know. It just happened. Thank God I noticed it in the middle of the recording before we did the whole thing and got none of it, because that would have really made me mad. So lots of times you get, you know, when you're doing an interview, I get lost in the conversation. I'm not looking at all the instruments all the time. I try to tell myself to, but I don't.
You get caught up in it.
You get caught up in it.
And, it just happens.
But anyway, so Seth was kind enough to restart. So we got everything done today. So very cool.
It worked out. Yeah, it worked out.
Yeah, yeah, so I was at a Renaissance fair with the Brud this weekend.
Did you buy them swords?
Oh, yeah, they got swords. Yes. Now, they, of course, like I talked about, I don't remember if it was the Elite show or the regular show. But, of course, they wanted chainmail and they wanted helmets, you know, real metal helmets. They
did
wanted.
You, wait, did you get them wooden swords?
No. Well, yes, Jacob and Luke got wooden swords. Of course, they wanted the real ones. And Caleb, he got an actual, like, dirk. He found him a dirk. Now, you know, it doesn't look like it's that great a quality, but he loves it.
And it's probably dull, so I mean,
I'm sure it was made in China or something like that. But he liked it, yeah, so we had a good time.
I'm surprised, but I'll tell you, not to cut you off, but I'm surprised you didn't have to purchase a hammer dulcimer while you were there.
But they were playing them.
I saw it. That's when I'm like, I know what's going to be at the house when we get there.
Well, oddly enough, you're going to enjoy this. After the course, you know, just like every time we go somewhere, you know, the first thing they see, they're like, I want that. Dad, can I get that? I'm like, why don't you look around? We're going to be here for like 5 hours before you make the decision, because if you buy this, then that's it. I only promised them I'd buy them one thing. Mm-hmm. So make it a good one. Well, some of them held out longer than others, but eventually, towards the end of the day, they've already made their choices, by the way. We walk by this archery shop, and they have longbows, from little tiny ones that are only like 3 feet tall to great big ones like the one you have, mm-hmm. that's like 6.5 foot tall, and wooden arrows fletched. I mean, these look awesome. And of course, they saw kids out there shooting them. I want that. You can't return the stuff we've already bought.
Sorry, bro.
That's why I go, look, man, I told you to wait. They never do. Next year, they're like, I'm getting one of those bows. Meanwhile, they have Bowtech, like $500
compound bows.
They got
nice compound bows.
They don't want the compound bows. They want the longbow. And I think it's because of the setting they were in.
Yeah.
You know,
they got caught up in it.
I get it, man. Longbows are cool. Recurves are cool. Atlatls are cool.
Did you have any mead or ale while you were there?
I had some sarsaparilla. It's pretty good.
Oh, there you go.
And I had some kind of meat on a stick. Now, it was supposed to be...
meat on a stick.
Some kind of sausage, but I'm not sure what it was that it was actually made from.
It's all natural.
It tasted like Nutria.
I'd have never had one. Lying.
With pork fat. Well, let's get into the news. Check this out. This comes from the BBC. The oldest human cam dies in Indonesia. Get this. They think his age was 146.
I actually read on some of this.
Right?
I actually saw this, yeah.
And if this is real, I mean, that is incredible. Now, according to his papers, Sadi Medjo, also known as Mba Goto, which is Grandpa Goto, was born in 1870. And they said Indonesia only started recording births at the year 1900. And there have been mistakes before. Yet officials told the BBC his papers looked valid. And based on his documents he provided the interviewers with, they think it's real. They said he was taken to the hospital on April 12th because of deteriorating health, of course. And 6 days later, he insisted on checking out to return back to his home. Now, his grandson told the BBC that since he came back from the hospital, he only ate a few spoonfuls of porridge and drank very little. And it only lasted a couple of days. And from that moment until his death, he refused to eat and drink. Now, when asked about the secret of his longevity, now Mba Goto told the BBC that last year that patience was key and that he had a long life because I have people that loved me looking after me. Get this, Cam. They said he was a heavy smoker until the end. He outlived 4 wives, 10 siblings, and all of his children. Now, in his village, he was a local hero, famous for telling great stories about the wars against Japan and Dutch colonizers. His grandson went on to say that his grandfather was buried on Monday morning in a local cemetery plot that he bought several years ago, and a tombstone that he already had that was sitting on the side of his house for many years was placed above his grave. He said he didn't ask for much, but before he died, he just wanted us, his family, to let him go. He said he was ready to leave. And that's why he was refusing to eat. He's like, I've been here long enough. Now, he said independently verified his age would make him older than the second oldest person, a woman named Jean Clement, who was 122 when she died. They consider this guy the longest living human being in recorded history. So if that is true, and the documents are not false, 146 years. I haven't even been alive 46 years.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I did see somewhere where they said that they were really looking into it because he claims to have been born 30 years before they started keeping documents in that area.
Right, that's correct.
So they weren't 100% on the sure, but apparently they're going to do some digging and try to...
1870.
Can you genetically test, I wonder, for that? Like, can they cut him in half and look at the rings like on a tree? I mean, I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
I don't know, but 1870, I mean, you're talking about almost... At the end of the Civil War is when this guy.
Can you imagine the things he saw? If it's true.
No wonder he's a good storyteller.
Yeah. 100. Yeah. Right. And he still might have been blowing and going if he'd started eating, but he's like, nah. Always, every time I hear those old stories, it makes me think of what was Burgess Meredith, that old actor, whenever he was in Grumpier Old Men.
Where he's smoking and eating bacon. Yeah.
And he goes, sometimes I think God forgot about me. You know, he's just sitting there, which my wife and my daughter both swear that that's going to be me and you. The grumpy old men, whether it's Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, that's going to be you and me whenever we get old.
What's up, jackass? You know, and
hey, like, Putz.
Hey, I'm fishing here. You know, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, exactly. I've got you something here from our homie over at Open Minds, Roger Marsh. And this is something a little bit different than normally what I report on when I start talking about like chevrons or diamonds or something. And I'm going to throw this out there. I think Kyle's going to enjoy this. Listen, it says an Ohio witness at Sagamore Hills Township reported driving toward an unknown light and discovered a hovering sphere just above the tree line. Now, this comes from the case 83449 from the Mutual UFO Network, the witness reporting database for all of you that want to do a little digging. The witness was actually driving home from a gym at 9:30 p.m. on April 30th, 2017, when this incident began. And the witness states this, for some reason, I passed up my street, continued down a main road, looking for somewhere to turn around, when a light caught my eye. I assumed it was a plane, but upon further inspection, I realized that it wasn't. It goes on to state that I parked my car in the middle of the side road, where either a saucer or possibly a sphere was hovering above the tree line. It stood hovering for a few minutes, silently, may I add, and then it darted incredibly quickly as if in 100 mile an hour or more, you know, hundreds, down the tree line, instantaneously changed direction back to its original location, and then shot up in the sky and out of sight. The witness goes on to state that incredibly hard to think of what else this could have been, and I can't disprove what I saw to myself. I then just sat in my car, dumbstruck, for a few minutes until returning home. And for those that want to look up on a map, the road is called Chaffee Road.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, look, I would love to say that this sounds just simply like a ball of light or something almost like a drone. But whenever the witness talks about the drone taking off and coming right back to the same spot, that's going to be kind of hard to do if you're flying this drone, you know. And also, too, you're going to hear the sound of the drone as it's flying off. And I'm assuming even though it's at night, you would understand the difference between how fast a drone is and how fast this thing they say is moving as it shoots down the tree line, shoots back, and then shoots straight up into the air and vanishes. You're not going to be able to make a drone vanish unless it got way up and then you turn the light off.
Yeah.
But this all goes back into the point of why would you be doing that to start with?
Man, I couldn't.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Why would you be flying around crazy with a drone just trying to fool somebody? But I like the idea of these glowing orbs because, like we've covered much in the past, these orbs almost feel like they actually have a presence, like a soul or a feeling to them, that it's not mechanical. It's more like it is a, like we talked about the spook lights or the ghost lights, or something to it that almost
makes it. The Marfa lights, yeah.
Yeah, it makes it feel like it is almost an organic presence in that orb.
Man, crazy. That is bizarre. Right? Well, back in October 18th of 2015, we did an episode called Mysteries of the Djinn, and it was talking about some of these stories. Well, recently I saw an article over on Mysterious Universe by Brent Swanser about some of these encounters with the djinn that some soldiers had back during the Iraqi war. And there's a really cool one, and it talks about how one such report, you know, comes back all the way from June of 2003, when apparently there was this soldier who had been stationed in Mosul, Iraq, with the United States Army and the infantry with the 101st Airborne Division. Now, according to this witness, at the time of the incident, he had just been involved in helping to suppress a riot that had broken out with locals who were, Cam, unhappy with the corrupt local police. And in order to protect the police, they said that squads were deployed to various stations 24/7 for their protection. And the witness happened to be at one of these squads one evening, keeping watch, they said, on a three-story police building located in a cramped section of town that was, of course, was zigzagged by narrow roads barely wide enough to drive through. Now, the witness describes what happened during his watch. He says, myself and two other guys from my squad were sitting on the balcony of the second floor of the station, pulling security on our shift. It was sometime in the night. If I had to guess, I would say it was around 2:30 a.m. Now, while on guard, we used the lights on our rifles to illuminate any car that drove by so we could see if there was any sort of weapons in the vehicle and stuff like that. We heard a car driving towards us from one side of the road in Mosque. So we get ready with our lights to illuminate the car when it came into view. Once we saw the car, we shined our lights into the vehicle, directing the light towards the driver. Now, the driver had a typical reaction to the surefire light, which is intensely bright, by squinting his eyes and attempting to look away from the light. The passenger, however, had a much different reaction. His eyes seemed to glow with intensity by the light. He stared right back at the light, almost looking through it and at us. It was very eerie. At the time, the best we could describe his eyes were that of like a cat. In the dark, you know, when a flashlight shines in its face. I've never heard of a person's eyes being able to reflect light like that any time before or after. Anything you could purchase to do such things in local stores, especially in a second or third world country. So the soldier thinks that what they were seeing was a djinn or a demon. Now, another sighting dealing with the djinn talks about somebody who was stationed at a forward operating base called Endurance in Iraq, which was more or less composed of just some simple tents and some airplane hangars that had been taken over from Iraqi forces. Now, one feature of this camp was a sturdy concrete bunker that was fully equipped with metal blast doors. And at some point during the soldier's deployment, the witness started a relationship up with a female soldier, and they chose the bunker to have their private meetings because it was secure with only one way out or in. And there was also a noisy generator that was situated just outside that they would be able to immediately hear if anyone opened the blast doors. They said, however, though, this bunker trips would not last long after this because the two of them had a very strange encounter in their camp. This is what it says. It says, here was what stopped the bunker trips. Well, about the second night on, Sarah would wake me in the middle of the night telling me she was hearing something inside the bunker with us. At first, I attributed the noise she was hearing to hedgehogs, as that part of Iraq was lousy with them. He said, I shrugged it off until I heard the noise, and there was no doubt. What we were hearing were footsteps. The night before the last night we stayed down there, I awoke to whispering coming from the corner, which was followed by footsteps that approached my side of the bed. Now, I woke Sarah and reluctantly turned my flashlight on, fearing what came next, but there was nothing. Nobody. No footprints. And worst of all, the blast doors were closed just like we had left it. The last night we were there started with Sarah warning whatever was down there that we were not in the mood to be messed with and that we just needed our sleep. We both fell asleep, and as we reassured each other, we were just hearing things. Again that night, Sarah woke me and we sat there in total darkness listening to whispers coming from the corner. This time it was two different voices, followed by footsteps approaching our bed, and then our bed violently shook for just a few seconds. And then a tremendous sound as if a metal plate had just been dropped next to the bed. In our panic, it took me a good 45 seconds to locate my flashlight. But once we were there and we turned it on, there was nothing. No footprints, no evidence of what made the loud crashing sound. And that was our last night in the bunker. So, much like the stories we did on that episode of Expanded Perspectives, is this, in fact, djinn? Is it ghost? What is it? Some kind of poltergeist? I mean, what is it that these people are seeing? Both demons, hearing things messing with them, whispers coming from the dark, no footprints, loud crashes. I don't know, man. And you hear a lot of these stories coming from wartime. I've heard of similar stories from back in World War II, even World War I, where I don't know if like all this fighting and stuff kind of opens a doorway almost to let these evil entities in. I don't know.
It is strange. It does make you wonder that.
It,
yeah.
It is crazy. Now, there's a couple more stories on that, and I'll put links to it in the show notes. You need to go over there and check that out. Cam, what else did you say you had?
I've got a time, missing time, not really a time slip, but missing time that fits in very well because it's always something that you and I have known somebody that had this happen to them whenever they were traveling. And this is just one of those, I want you to listen to this. Nalan posted this up on Phantoms and Monsters, and he had actually received this. And this is, it just apparently recently happened. It says, hi, I live near Springfield, Illinois, and about to graduate from college, and last week I had a weird experience and didn't know who to tell, and this is a brief description of what happened. I was in my car at night when I suddenly got the feeling that something was about to happen. I felt great power and kindness surrounding me. I wasn't afraid, even though I could no longer hear the music on my radio or the sound of my car. Then suddenly I saw lights ahead of the car, and these lights seemed familiar to me. It's hard to explain. I believe I went into a trance, but never lost control of my car. And when I regained my full faculties, I discovered that I had lost 2 hours and was almost 70 miles from where I was originally. I also had extreme thirst and hunger. Now, last night I had a dream, or possibly a recall, being on board an object and meeting a human-like man who was tall with long black hair, bright greenish eyes, and spoke English. This man, in particular, seemed to be the leader. The rest of the crew were shorter than him, with opaque white skin and wearing white jumpsuits. They never communicated with me. I was taken to what looked to be a command center. There I was shown a mirrored window in which I could see star charts and weird drawings. The tall man showed me how to look correctly at these images and to understand their meaning. The floor was like glass and gave me vertigo at one point. I soon awoke, but I believe it was connected to my lost time incident. KS is who sent that in.
Wow.
Right? So it always makes me wonder, this lost time stuff is... Because we've received a bunch of stories emailed to us about people talking about this sort of same thing of where they have like lost time, maybe not this long, some, you know, longer, things like that. But it does seem like later on, somehow your body, your subconscious cues it back up and allows you to go, like, it's only like whatever they implant or whatever they put across you to make you not know what happened right then slowly wears off.
Yeah.
You know, within, say, 24 hours, it's almost like a haze that they dip you in. But yeah, it seems to wear off.
Man, that is creepy.
Isn't that pretty wild?
Yeah, missing time scares me. I always think bad things are happening. I know a couple people that have experienced that in their life, and what a terrifying thing to happen to you.
70 miles, too?
Man.
70 miles away.
Man.
Right?
Man,
it's pretty crazy.
I don't even like to think about it. It makes me shudder.
Well, speaking of pretty crazy, folks, we had the pleasure to have Mr. Seth Breedlove jump on here with us again.
Again, yeah.
Again. And like we said, we kind of had a rough go, but we've got it all worked out, the whole thing, and we're going to have him come on. He's talking about the Mothman of Point Pleasant, which is he alluded to whenever we had him on the first time, and it's one of those deals. Man, he is a grinder. He gets in there and he works. And he's a master storyteller.
Yeah.
And he does it visually. And every movie he does has gotten better every time it's done. And it's not like he was bad to start with. You know, it's not like if you gave me a camera and I had to learn. Seth is awesome at it. And I love the way he tells the story. Our good amigo Lyle is actually the one that does the narration even in this show.
Yeah.
It's just great. So when we get back from the break, you're going to hear us chatting it up with Seth as he discusses basically his experiences and what he found during that movie. We hope you enjoy it, folks. Thank you so much for being here today with us. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. All right, folks, here we go again. Yeah, I say again, this is the interview that we had with our amigo, the one and only man of small town monsters, Seth Breedlove, talking about the Mothman of Point Pleasant movie, his newest film, Take Two, folks. That's right, the Mothman showed up here in studio and crushed us and erased things and destroyed things. But Seth, being the kind gentleman he is, agreed to come back on and let's try this again. So, brother, round two, how's it going?
It's still good. It's still good. I took a nap in the 20 minutes we weren't talking, and I'm ready to go, ready to rock.
For those of you that don't know, Seth is the father of a bouncing brand new baby boy, And he's been making his own hard times on Seth. And, of course, everybody knows, you know, when you have them youngins around, that they like to sleep, but they don't want you to. That's pretty much how they feel about life. So this is going to be fun because, like we said, now we've kind of discussed it. It was almost like an off-air discussion. So we're going to jump right into it, folks. For those of you that are unaware and have been hiding in a cave or under a rock or down in the Congo about what Seth's done, he is the man behind Minerva Monster, Beast of Whitehall, and Boggy Creek Monster. It felt like we laughed. It felt like we had Seth on literally just 30 days ago. He brought up the fact that I'm going to do Mothman to Point Pleasant. Next thing you know, yeah, it's done. He's like, hey, I finished it. What's up, yo? I can't even imagine, and I still can't, after the work that you've put into all of this and the way you dig into all of these things, I guess, with lack of a better term, okay, what got you to point even in this direction? What made you decide you wanted to tell this story as opposed to another story of those out there?
It was the human tragedy at the heart of the story, which is the Silver Bridge collapse. And that is something we haven't got to explore any kind of like major catastrophe or tragedy in one of our films. And there was a point last year at the Mothman Festival where a local police officer in Point Pleasant came over to my table, and him and I were just kind of chatting. And he started telling me about his recollections of the day the bridge collapsed. And he had been in school with a young girl who died on the bridge. And he recalled going down to the scene of the bridge collapse and planting a tree on the side of the hill there in her memory. And after that conversation, I kind of decided that this was probably the story for us. And I started to have this thought that maybe we could tell something, a version of the story that hasn't been told, which is to focus in on the human element a lot more, and really let the people of the town kind of explain everything for themselves, while also kind of detailing the crazy 13-month span of time that involved that bridge collapse. But it was that really, the Silver Bridge was what drew me to the story to begin with. And I have to ask you guys, because we've already done the interview, and I've already talked to you once, so mm-hmm. I gotta ask you, because we talked about it a little bit, but I mean, you guys dug the movie, huh?
Yes.
Oh, amazing.
Tremendously. Yes.
I like all of your films, but I think, you know, each time you do one, you're getting a little better. It's like, you know, much like anything else, you seem to be becoming a master. Like before, you might have had a purple belt. Now you're starting to get your black belt in making these documentaries, because it's incredible. The narration is perfect with Lyle Blackburn. I think he could do voiceover work anywhere. The guy's got a great cadence and a great way of telling the story. The timeline you put on the film, I like that, because I've seen all these, you know, I've heard of these different sightings, but I never knew how they went and what order they went in.
That's me, yeah.
So I appreciate that. And I also loved the reenactments that you did it with animation. It fit the story so perfect. I mean, it just makes it come alive. Like when the woman and her brother are driving in the car and the thing's flying or running or whatever right next to her in the window. When you're seeing the animation along with the story, it's just, I love it. You're doing an incredible job. I take my hat off to you, sir.
Okay, cool. What about the bridge sequence? How did you respond to it?
Well, sadly, look, I love, like we said, there was the crescendo. I feel the filmmaker storyteller part of you come out in that part of the movie, like the buildup. You can feel that as it grows and grows. It's almost also knowing the story. I feel that ominous weight slowly building to where I know that it's going to change. The thing that happened to me, and I talked to you about it, you know, whenever before we lost the last one, I talked to you about it, is I think it was hard for me to put together the fact that this is just a town of 5,000 people, folks. Everybody knows everybody. So when they lost people in that bridge collapse, it affected that town to the core. That is something that you could only imagine, that if this was just hearsay, if this was as far as when I say this, the sightings of this Mothman or these Birdman or whatever it was, if this was all something that, say, was added later, you know that the town elders wouldn't allow it, because it would be insulting to the people that died in that bridge collapse, which, like I said, you did a very good, a moving way of showing that and bringing that out. that's another thing that I think adds to the validity to me of these stories is, you know, it'd be one thing like if you had lost a loved one and then somebody come along and go, oh, yeah, well, that person was killed due to like the ghost that was on this highway. And you'd be like, look, don't add that to the story. She lost control, or this woman lost control due to the rain. Something along those lines. You wouldn't want to mix them together. But It's almost like the people of this town kind of bonded together over this. And I like the way you told the story, because I was unaware of the story of all these sightings prior to all of this. You bring up, like, for 50 years before this Mothman sighting, there were sightings of birdmen all around in that area within an hour of that whole town of Point Pleasant. Other people had been reported seeing not just that, but other strange things in that area. So this was, you could feel it building to something. And like I said, knowing the way the story goes, I think he did a great job of building that up, because you could always, it's almost like, the only way I could relate it to is the Titanic. You start off going, all right, but you already know in the back of your mind, this is going to go bad. I know this is going to go bad. And you built it up perfectly for me while still telling the story, but also not like over the top with the bridge collapse. Because there's been some shows that's all it stems on is that. And I like the way you told it with the people, and you let the people tell their story.
Yeah, and that the footage, the 8mm footage we had in there, that's the first time that has been seen by the public. That footage was a family kind of heirloom of the Walmsley family. That was actually shot by Jeff's father or his uncle. I can't remember which one he told me. And that has been something that's just been within their family. No one outside of it has ever seen it. So they actually let us put that in the film. So that's the first time that stuff has been seen. And I told the story to the editor at the local paper there the other day. That footage, I actually edited that sequence, the bridge sequence, out of order. I edited it very early on in the making of the movie. I just woke up one day and wanted to work on the Silver Bridge sequence. And I sat there for 14 hours putting all that together. And when I got done with it, I took Judy Collins' version of Amazing Grace and I stuck it under that sequence. And by the time I was done watching it, I was in tears, which you never should say something like that about your own work, because it just makes you sound like a complete egomaniac. But it wasn't necessarily, I mean, it definitely wasn't my, you know, the fact that I was sitting there like, this is just a beautiful editing job. It was like the emotional kick of like hearing Denny's description of what happened that day, and George's description of remembering going down to the flood wall with his father. And then that shot, I love the shot where the camera pans along the flood wall and you can just see the hill leading down to the river lined with people, family members waiting to see their loved one's body drug up from the lake. That's what they're the river. That's what that is. It's difficult to make that out, but there's a shot right toward the end. I don't know if you guys know the shot I'm referring to, but there's a shot in there that I absolutely think is incredibly emotionally impactful.
Well, and also too, to play on that, is we're talking about a time whenever the phone lines were down because everybody was congesting them. They didn't know. We don't have cell phones. They couldn't just pick it up and call them and say, are you okay? Are you on the other side? They didn't know. So everybody there, like you said, is lined up waiting to see if their son or daughter or mother or sister, who's in there. They're just waiting for that. And it's that,
right,
like we had talked about in the past, Kyle and I have discussed almost like the thing with the battle at Gettysburg. There's a darkness in that area. And it feels like we talked about, there was a darkness in this area, the weight of everything, and especially after that happened. And you brought up something in the movie, and we discussed earlier, the story of Chief Cornstalk. You got to get back into that. That is a great thing, because I know a lot of people hang their hat on it. That was one of the first things that I remember picking up on a long time ago. So if you can tell, lay the story and then what you found out later on.
Well, the Cornstalk, Chief Cornstalk was a Native American chieftain in the area back when the first settlers were there. And the Native Americans had avoided kind of settling on the location where Point Pleasant is today because of the fact that two rivers mingle there, and apparently they consider that a bad omen. So they've avoided the area. And Chief Cornstalk was tasked with kind of brokering a peace treaty between the local Indian tribes and the settlers. And he ended up, him and his sons were murdered by a couple of the men at the fort, Fort Randolph, there in Point Pleasant. And supposedly this legend had sprung up that, Chief Cornstalk, before his death, as he was laying there dying from bullet wounds, which right there is kind of a that's a tip off that this whole thing is an urban legend, because I mean, you guys probably have seen a musket bullet from the 1700s. The odds of you getting shot with multiple of those, because they were shot, I think, seven times, something like that, and then laying there and having a conversation or letting out a curse, slim to none that would happen. But supposedly, you know, as Cornstalk was laying there, he let out this whole curse, and the curse was actually there were places where you could actually find the curse, and it was a very detailed curse. It was sentences long, maybe paragraphs long, you know, detailing his curse on the town of Point Pleasant. And when we were there, we spoke to Chief Cornstalk's seventh generation granddaughter, and Lynn. And Lynn told us that story, that the curse had actually originated in a play in the early 1900s. And you know, we thought that was a really kind of cool little Easter egg. So we were planning on, hey, let's put this in the movie. But the next day after we shot Lynn's interview, we shot our interview with Denny. Denny Bellamy, who runs the tourism center where we shot a lot of those early interviews. And Denny, as during the middle of his interview, says, hey, you know, by the way, we actually have the play out there on display where that curse kind of originated. And sure enough, they actually showed us the play. And actually in the movie, we do pan down the playbill where you can actually see the lines, you know, that Chief Cornstalk supposedly uttered in this play. And that is really, it seems to be, anyway, that's where the Chief Cornstalk, the Cornstalk curse, kind of originated. A lot of people had actually said that, you know, when Cornstalk had placed that curse, the Mothman was actually a part of that curse, that somehow, I've heard this anyway, that in Shawnee, in the Shawnee belief system or whatever, there's some sort of large winged entity, and that's what the Mothman was, you know, somehow connected to that curse. But it seems to us, and from what we can find out, is that curse didn't even exist until the early 1900s, when it was something that had, you know, been placed in a Cornstalk's mouth. The unfortunate part about that is that they teach that curse in some of the schools. I don't know that they still do today, but they teach that in Point Pleasant history as if it's historical fact. And it's so bad that there's actually a pretty negative outlook toward Native Americans by some people in the area still because of that supposed curse.
Well, and I like you'd even touched on that, because it seemed like they had blamed Chief Cornstalk in the past for the flooding. There was three, you know, major floods within a certain amount of time there, and they had blamed him in the past for a lot of that. And it was great how you actually pointed that out. And then like that, you wrap up like, look, it's not real. It's something that some playwright wrote up and added to this, you know, as a little spice here and there. But it's the thing's not true. But what is true is all the strange sightings, or at least the reports. I can't tell if the sightings are true, but the reports of these sightings are true, that has happened around there of this bird man way prior to all of this. And we'd even discussed too about the grave diggers and what they saw.
Yeah, the sightings kind of originally, what everyone knew of was the Scarberry Mallet sightings that took place near the TNT factory area. But there was a reported sighting that took place a few days prior to that in Clendenin, West Virginia, which is about an hour from Point Pleasant. Some guys were digging a grave, and they said they saw a man-like creature with wings perched in a tree that eventually flew away. There was another sighting that actually took place even before that, at the Point Pleasant National Guard Armory. Someone on duty at the armory claimed to see a glowing red-eyed, large winged creature in a tree behind the armory. And of course, the armory sits directly behind the armory is kind of the McClintock Wildlife Management Area. So it's the same kind of wood line that would connect to that TNT area where, you know, later the Scarberry Mallets would have their own encounter and kind of kick the whole thing off. And that the cool thing about that National Guard Armory sighting that I found out, that that has occasionally been cited. Some people have mentioned that that encounter, but frequently I think it's kind of dismissed. But I talked to Jeff Wamsley about that sighting, the National Guard Armory sighting, and he told me his father actually worked at the National Guard at that time. And there was definitely talk going on around the armory around that same time that that encounter had happened. So at least we have some sort of verification that if nothing else, people were talking about it. So yeah, the Clendenin sighting is credited as the first, but technically it would be that National Guard armory sighting.
So it goes back. See, and that's part of it that we have heard, you know, these tales of certain things, but you'd even gone up and dug up so many more of them. And there's another thing, and I said that I really appreciate that you do. It's kind of an ongoing thing in your movies now, but this was one of them that was really great. Is you got to have, because so many of the people have passed away that were involved in this, because they were much older when all this even went down, but you actually used interviews and even some video interviews that had Miss Bennett, Marcella Bennett, in it. Also with what's his name, Bob Bobsworth. You there was several of those that you get, and it's something that you can feel a difference in the way they tell their stories. It's not just like a reenactment of somebody reading the transcript of what they had happen, or, you know, even the reenactment of it. It's different when you have the actual witness tell it, because you can tell, like we discussed, how much it affects them as compared to just. And also it has a different impact on the viewer as whenever it's just somebody randomly that's discussing the transcript or talking about it. How did you get, lucky enough to be able to use that?
With the historical interviews, there's a few different ones in there. The Marcella Bennett interview was recorded, videoed by a guy named Jonathan Heat, who actually used it in a kind of small scale documentary. I actually stumbled across that on YouTube and then convinced him. There wasn't a lot of convincing. He was very giving of it to use that in our film. Our biggest problem with that interview was that the resolution was so low. For me to use that in our movie, it was going to look ridiculous. It was going to be so heavily pixelated, you probably wouldn't have even been able to make out Marcella's face. My idea there was, hey, why don't we take a projector down to the TNT area, get a generator in there, and shoot the projector projecting Marcella's interview onto the wall of the inside of one of the igloos. So that's why technically that, you know, I've had a lot of people tell us they love the way that looks, and but it really, that was born out of necessity more than anything else. We just needed a way for that to look visually interesting and be a little different from the, you know, what you would typically see with like a black box, you know, on screen. Because the if we had done that, just like shown her interview within the movie, it would have been incredibly low resolution.
It worked perfect.
I really like the way that scene plays out, actually. But we did that one, and then the audio taped interviews were recorded by Jeff Wamsley, and he gave those to us after being convinced by his daughter Ashley, who had seen one of our movies and trusted us to be, you know, I guess, respectful toward the witnesses and stuff. So he allowed us to use those audio taped interviews in the movie, and obviously those play out with Chris's animated sequences playing over those. If I can use the original voice of the witnesses in our movies, I will. I as much as I love Lyle's narration, and I like narration, and it helps to obviously tell a story that's on this scale, I would prefer it just to have locals and witnesses tell the story if I could. That's why Minerva, that's one of the reasons Minerva Monster is the way it is. But with something this big, you almost have to have Lyle in there telling, you know, to fill in the blanks. And plus, with so many of these people passing away, it's difficult to find living witnesses. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we have, let me think, we have what, 6 or 7 in the movie. So we have a lot of the original witnesses because of those audio taped interviews. And we even got Merle Partridge in there to tell his story, and he passed away years ago. So, and Bob Bosworth is gone now too. Tom Urey's still alive, but we, he's in a nursing home and unable to speak about it. So we had that in there as well. So we lucked out on this movie. We really did. I don't know that there would be a movie without those audio taped interviews.
Well, and speaking of interviews, we have to discuss, which is what we talked, is our favorite of the thing. And then you even touched on how that's one of your favorites too, is the interview you did with Lawrence Gray. And what out of all, and we've even discussed this, and it's funny because Kyle and I talk about, like I said, all the time, is it's when you see somebody that's visually moved by their story, it almost adds that there's a human element to it. Whenever you can tell, it's like when you watch someone who's talking about the loss of a loved one in any video or things, it hits you. There's an impact that it has on you that's different than if you just hear it, or it's the whole thing works on a human element. It's kind of hard to describe. And that's what you got with Mr. Gray, the school teacher there. And we had laughed because this happened to him over 50 years ago. And it still sticks with me. What he ends up talking about affects him as much today as it did over 50 years ago. Can you just drop a little knowledge on the listeners about that little interview?
Yeah, his story goes that one night him and his wife were at church, and they came home from church and the back door of their house was unlocked, which they thought was unusual. He came into the house and said that he could sense something in the house, like someone was there that shouldn't be there. He went through the whole house, found nothing. And that night him and his wife went to bed, and sometime during the middle of the night, he wakes up and the Mothman is standing at the foot of his bed. And he described it as basically like having an encounter with the devil in his bedroom that night. And it's something that stuck with him to this day. He's in his 70s. And it's by far the most kind of impactful interview we've ever done, because you could clearly see this guy is still deeply, deeply affected by this. Even to this day, it still affects him in a major way. And we all kind of agreed after the interview that was probably the best interview with a witness we've done, because of the fact that you could see that it was still emotionally racking to this guy to even talk about this. We actually only conducted that interview for about 18 minutes. That interview ran 18 minutes long. Usually I'll do an interview, they run about a half hour or more, depending on who we're talking to. Obviously we've done interviews that run 4 hours, but with a witness interview, it's usually pretty quick. You want to get them in and out. You want them to show a lot of emotion, obviously. And to do that, sometimes you have them repeat sections of the story. With Lawrence, there was none of that. It was like, tell us your story. And what you're seeing on camera in the movie is basically him telling his story right then. So all of that, there was no coaxing. That's all him telling his story and having that much of an emotional reaction to it. So it's definitely was our favorite interview from the film.
Man, it was just great. The whole thing was great. And I'm still blown away by the fact that there was so much that I thought I knew about it, but everything that I thought I knew about it based around the bridge collapse. And then you have the fella, you know, that the tourism board there, and you have him talking about it and how it affected him. And it just, I think that's something that goes lost, let's say, in some of the other movies or documentaries, is the effect it has on the township in itself. And I don't mean just the collapse of the bridge. This whole dark, ominous weight from this thing that started building up before all that, because of these sightings that these kids had. And then, you know, the two couples had it, and it chased them in the car, and the guys on the motorcycles, what they saw. You go through all these things, and there's an ominous feeling in this town all the time. But I think it missed, and that's something that you've done great in a lot of your movies, is you seem to always go back and focus on the core of the ominous feeling that's the weight of that town. Not just, you like to single them out, which is great. That's my favorite part, of course, is the stories like we talked about with Lawrence. But the way you focus in on the town and how much it's kind of molded that whole town, because they even bring up is, guys were like, if there's more than one, can we kill them both? Everybody's got their guns out. It changed the dynamic of that entire town of 5,000 people. Do you set out to do that, or is it just something that kind of grows organically when you start doing these shows?
You definitely. I mean, that's what drew me to the whole thing, because I grew up in a small town. So those the dynamics of how the town reacts to something like this is really important. And when it comes to like the posses hunting the creature and all that, that stuff is so. That's what draws me to this. You know, like I want to see a Mothman movie. Directed by Steven Spielberg, that's like 1970s Jaws, where the town is out in the woods hunting for the creature and everyone's losing it. I mean, that really is the culture. The way it affects the culture of the community is what initially drew me to all this stuff. So I love the sighting encounters and that kind of thing as well. But I think what draws me in is the again, like that personal kind of connection to it, the human element of the story. And when you get into those, you know, the fact that there were people out hunting the creature and the National Guard had to come in and direct traffic through the TNT area because there were so many cars trying to line up to get in there. You know, it put me in mind of the Minerva case, where you had so many cars parked along Route 30 that they had to shut down Route 30 at one point, you know, so because cars couldn't get through. And it put me in that same sort of mindset. But I think this was a lot bigger. I mean, the story, this was a much bigger event going on, you know, in Point Pleasant. And the fact that, you know, like you mentioned it earlier, the story almost laid dormant for a while. The Mothman sightings almost laid dormant for a while, even with Keel's book out there, until the movie came out. And then the Mothman Prophecies movie came out, and I think that kind of clued Jeff into the fact that, hey, maybe there is an interest in this, and I could, you know, find an audience of people who would be interested in looking into the history of this case. And that's kind of what brought it back into the public eye there. What I want to know is, like, how many of these stories around the country are there that people have completely forgotten about that still exist, you know, that we should try to dig up, you know, maybe stories that didn't reach the local papers or didn't reach national media that people back in the whatever era they took place were aware of, but have since been completely lost or forgotten, because those stories definitely exist. I definitely am much more drawn to like the cultural impact on the community and the human side of the stories than I am the kind of eyewitness accounts and all that stuff. And when it came to this story, I think we set out to make the Mothman movie we wanted to see. You know, there's a lot of Mothman documentaries out there, and I hadn't seen one that very clearly and concisely kind of explained the timeline of how all of this was going on and how each thing was kind of impacting the next. And some of these sightings that we got in here, you know, I don't think I'd seen in other forms of media, you know, or books, movies, whatever, about the Mothman. The one that springs to mind is the sighting of the two businessmen who were driving on 77 around the same time that Woodrow was on 77, and they encountered the grinning man, but they were heading northbound. So Derenberger's headed southbound, and shortly thereafter, these two guys headed northbound also encounter a grinning, you know, what they referred to as the grinning man on 77 in the same general area as Woodrow's sighting. I just thought that was such a cool kind of connection there, that there might have been a second Indrid Cold encounter shortly after Woodrow's.
I love the fact, like, the whole thing with the grinning man, that was something that we didn't ever think about till much later. And then people have gone back and been like, but that's what they described. Was the grinning man that they came in contact with. Because that was, you know, that was one of those things. It's like, oh, an afterthought of, oh, man, there it is. But I'm 100% with you. How many more towns out there have stories like this that's untapped, that you just don't really think of? Man, you obviously would be busy to no end. Let me ask you this. After you did this, of course, I always ask you, you know, after every time we have you on, we ask, did it change your mind after you was on? Like, after you did this show, did you learn anything that maybe made you lean one way or another, that you were different when you went into it?
I think coming into it, I was much more, I was convinced it was an owl or a sandhill crane coming into it. And now I'm not, I have no idea what to think. To me, there's nothing not that there's nothing, but it does seem like many of these people were seeing multiple types of Mothman. So the Mothman encounters or the Mothman descriptions, they don't all line up. What the Gallup Police Airport pilots describe seeing doesn't sound like what Lawrence Gray described seeing in his bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes me wonder, well, you know, is this a government, some sort of government experiment? Is, you know, so I think coming into it, I was convinced I knew what had happened or had some a fairly good idea of what had happened. And now I'm just like, I have no clue. And the cool thing about that to me is I will probably continue reading about this and looking into the story for a lot longer than I normally do. Usually we finish a film and I'm kind of done with it for a while. You know, I've moved on from, mm-hmm. from that story on to the next one. And this is one where I definitely think I'll be reading every book that comes out about it and continuing to try to do my own research into the story.
It got its
hooks
in. Just
because I think there's so much to it.
It got its hooks in you. You went and visited one and now it's got you. Well, and you don't have to, of course. Can you share any information on something upcoming projects that you might have before we have you talk about when this one's going to drop?
Yeah. Next is the Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, which we just actually started shooting some B-roll for yesterday. And that is kind of, this is going to be a different type of small town monsters movie. It's still going to focus in on one particular town. It's going to have, the focus is going to be Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, where the UFO was said to crash back in the mid-60s. But it's going to balloon out from there and encompass the entire Chestnut Ridge area of Pennsylvania, which is this nearly 100-mile-long stretch of mountain range that runs through PA. And it's got a long history of bizarre sightings. But in the mid-70s, there was kind of a heightening of that, and basically there was a massive amount of UFO activity and really bizarre creature encounters. You know, like people seeing Bigfoots disappearing into UFOs, mm-hmm. and shooting at Bigfoots and seeing them disappear in a flash, and all kinds of weird stuff that we normally have avoided. But since this is part of the High Strangeness trilogy of the Small Town Monsters movies, I was ready to open the door and really dive into the bizarre. So that's what we're doing. It's going to focus on that kind of 72 through 74 flap that was detailed in Stan Gordon's book, Silent Invasion. We've got some awesome witnesses lined up from this, from 73 and 74. We've got Chris Scalf coming back to do at least a couple animated sequences. I do think this is going to be a shorter film, like a Beast of Whitehall length, maybe a little bit longer than that is kind of the plan for this one. But I think visually it's going to be probably going a little bit more back toward like Boggy Creek Monster. We're using all the same gear that we did on Boggy Creek and stuff. But it's going to be very kind of different from our other movies, as far as it's not necessarily going to focus on just one town. It's going to be a much broader look at this whole region of Pennsylvania. And we're definitely very excited to do this. We were down on the Chestnut Ridge yesterday for the bulk of the day, and the scenery down there is unbelievable. We were there in the middle of a torrential downpour for much of the day too, so we got some really cool kind of moody footage while we were down there. We start this will shoot starting on June 2nd, and probably the goal for this is to have it released on October 24th is what we're eyeing for the release date for this. And then in 2018, we are working on a guidebook to small town monsters that's going to be written by myself and Mark Matsky with a couple special guests that are familiar to the Small Town Monsters fan base, if such a thing exists.
I believe it does.
Well, and then we have some really cool stuff to announce. I'm just not sure yet when we're going to do it, but we're going to be opening the door to Small Town Monsters to another filmmaker who's going to come in and work on a Small Town Monsters project kind of with us, that's going to focus on a case that I've always wanted to do, but I'm just not going to have the time to, and he's ready to kind of take the reins and take a look at this case. And he's someone who's extremely talented. I would never let just anyone make a small town monsters movie, mm-hmm. but this is someone who I totally trust, and he's got a definite voice and a style of his own. And so that's going to happen in 2018, along with a feature length movie that we'll be doing as well. So the plan is for Small Town Monsters, two movies in 2018, along with a book. And we've got another movie coming this year besides Mothman.
Man, you sound like a busy fella, Seth.
Now Mothman comes out in June.
Yeah, June 2nd. The official release date, it'll be on iTunes, Amazon, Vimeo On Demand, DVD. There's a cool DVD we put together. And then the official premiere, like the world premiere for the movie, takes place at the Mothman Festival mm-hmm. in September. So that'll be kind of the first big public screening of the film.
Well, tell the folks where they can watch any of your movies, not just the newest one, Beast of Whitehall, Minerva Monster, Boggy Creek Monster, and also if they want to help, you know, support your upcoming work, how they can go over there and donate to you.
The best way, I think the easiest way for people to watch the movies now is Amazon. You just go on Amazon. You can actually watch Minerva Monster right now for free, although we'll be swapping back over to Beast of Whitehall here soon. And then probably next fall, Boggy Creek Monster will enter the prime rotation that we're trying to do, where we're switching back and forth every couple of months. So Amazon, we've got everything up. Vimeo On Demand for streaming. We're working on getting everything out there on iTunes, Google Play, all that stuff as well. Boggy Creek Monster, sometime in the next 2 months, should be available everywhere as far as streaming. So Google Play, PlayStation Store, Xbox, all that stuff, possibly Hulu, Vudu, all those. We don't do like a donation or anything like that, but if you want to buy stuff from us, shop.smalltownmonsters.com. We got t-shirts. The Mothman t-shirt designed by Sam Sheeran should be in the store in the next couple of days, actually. I'll be going to pick those up this week. And that's a great way to like support the films. We do a Kickstarter at the beginning of each year, which I'm 100% sure we'll be doing again in 2018. So I guess stay tuned for that. That will be a Kickstarter to fund both movies we plan on putting out in 2018, along with the book. So 2018 is going to be a big year, and this year we're kind of just getting going. It just, for some reason, since we finished Mothman, it feels like the year's winding down, but it's only May and we have a whole nother movie coming out. So
it's winding it's gonna up.
It's going to be a big year, and we've got events coming up around the state of Ohio and then even the country. I'll be in Montana in September doing a screening of Boggy Creek Monster and then speaking at the Big Sky Bigfoot Conference. And then we have a screening of the Mothman movie at Lauren Coleman's International Cryptozoology Conference in September. So we've got a lot coming up this year. It's going to be a crazy year.
And you've got a Facebook page and all that stuff and where everybody can go and find and keep all the updates and all that too.
Yeah, definitely. That's actually the best place to kind of keep track of that. And if you want to interact with us, or we do like a once a month Q&A, like a live Q&A that we record at a local radio station. We record it through Facebook Live, and we just let people ask us questions on Facebook, and then we answer them on the air and kind of let the people watching guide the flow of the show. So if you're into filmmaking or cryptids, that is a kind of a cool way to learn a little bit more about both.
Well, thank you so much, man, for taking the time. I know you're busy.
Yeah.
And with the baby, with the movie, with everything else. So, look, take a little time for yourself, man. Slow down.
Eventually.
We don't want you to lose it and go missing and go crazy. Then we got to do a movie about you. And who's going to do all that? See, we
have I'll be the subject of my next movie.
That's right. Exactly, man. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to hang out with us, Seth. We wish you all the best, man. And we'll make sure to support you, sir.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I love Seth and his movies, man. They are so good. Now, if you haven't seen these other ones, you need to check them out. There's the Minerva Monster. There's the Beast of Whitehall. And, of course, there's the Boggy Creek Monster. And you can watch those on Amazon or Vimeo. And those are all excellent movies. And this new one, The Mothman of Point Pleasant, comes out this June. So when that comes out, we'll be talking about it again. You got to make sure you watch this and support small town monsters. If you're into cryptozoology, you're going to love these films. I mean, these are documentaries about the stuff that we like. And, you know, like Cam was saying, they're excellently done. It's not cheesy, man. They're awesome. The film shots are good. The reenactments are fine. The narration is perfect. The timeline, the history he gets into on all of his documentaries. I just love them. I love the way they're shot in particular. They're very, very cool. Now, for you normal listening Expanded Perspectives fans, those who are not Elite members, you don't know what we were talking about when we started to do this, but on Elite, we started to float out the idea of Q&A with Cam and Kyle. Lots of times people send us these emails wanting to know just things about me and Cam. And so we decided to embrace that. And so on the Elite show, we said, hey, listen, if you're listening to this and you'd like to ask us a question, you could be about anything. Make sure you put in the title of your email, Q&A with Cam and Kyle. Send us the question and we'll try to answer it to the best of our ability. Now, look, we can't read all of them because we already got hit with a flood. But we're offering the same thing to you, Expanded Perspectives listeners. If you have some questions for me and Cam, put in the title Q&A with Cam and Kyle and ask us the question. So, Cam.
Yes, sir.
Do you want to get into some of these questions that we got? Let's do three.
Okay.
How about that?
Let's see.
The first one is from somebody called Coyote Man 5. And this is the question. It says, I sent this question before to you guys, and you said it was a tough question and that you needed time to think about it. If you could travel back in time, what three times would you like to travel back to witness or experience? Thanks, Brian O. from Oregon. Love you guys and your show. Keep doing what you're doing. So, Cam, would you like to go first? You want me to go first?
Sure.
Let's see. Break it down from 3, 2, 1. One being your favorite.
My favorite. Okay, number three for me would be Ancient Egypt. I want to go back to the time that the pyramids were built. I want to witness those pyramids being built.
You want to go back to the time of the construction of the pyramids? The
construction of the pyramids, yes.
Okay, my number three, I would have to say, I would like to go to a small island in Lake Michigan at the year 3000 BC to a little place called Isle Royale. I'd like to watch the copper mining going on there.
There you go.
And I would just like to see not just the people copper mining, but the whole logistics of how they were shipping it back to Europe, shipping it to the Mediterranean, the Phoenicians. Mm-hmm. Who was doing it? I'd like to see the people because, you know, the Native Americans in that area, they have stories of these folks with white beards and stuff. And, you know, Native Americans don't have white beards.
Yeah.
And so that would be number three for me. What was your number two?
Number two is kind of like yours. I would like to go back in time, in North America, to the time during the Reign of the Giants.
Oh.
I would like to see the history. I'd like to see if it is real, if it is a true thing. I would like to be there to witness the big giant communities.
I'm with you.
Of the giants. So that's probably my number three, is to go back and actually be part of that up along the Valley River, the Mississippi Valley and all that stuff, to where they were the like kind of like Cahokia, but where it was all with the giants.
Aztalan.
Yes. I would like to visit all of that.
There you go. My number two choice would be, I would say, Central America, the year 1519, the height of the Aztec Empire.
Ooh, there
you go. I would like to see that. Since I saw the movie,
Apocalypto.
That's it. I've been very interested in that culture. I would just like to see the beheading of 100,000 people in like 3 days.
What?
No, the culture I'm talking about, not the actual beheading. I would just like to see, you know, that's madness to me when you hear the stories. I would like to experience what that culture was like.
Gotcha.
What is your number one?
My number one would be at the peak of its existence, the peak of the time everyone was converging on Göbekli Tepe.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
Yeah, I would like to see that.
That would be pretty interesting.
The only reason I say that is because right now, that's the one thing that I know for a fact. I mean, I know they're working on Gulyong Padang and they're digging into that, but that's the one thing that I would really like to be at, because we know the age right now of it's over 14,000 years, and I would like to see what peoples were visiting that.
That would be very cool, man. I'd like to accompany you if I could.
Yeah.
My number one, I would go back to the year 48 BC, I would like to go to a town in Egypt, a town known as Alexandria. I'd like to see the Library of Alexandria, to see and read all the mysteries.
But it's not written in English, so what are you going to have to talk about
I'm
then?
Saying if I could, you know, talk
to someone. Well, then you're going to need a superpower, basically.
Yeah, basically. But I would like to know about the lost wisdom, because apparently there was so much lost during that fire that it talked about, you know, everything in antiquity. That would be very cool. Well, thank you for that question. Pretty cool. Cam, let's move on to another one. This one comes from DemulCare1. It says, hey guys, I'm an elite listener from Japan. I love listening to the stories you tell about the mysteries of history, but my favorite thing is hearing that Texas accent that is so rare in Japan. My question is this: if you could magically learn the full and complete answer or true story behind one of the mysteries you have discussed about on the shows, aliens, cryptids, archaeology, whatever, which one would you choose? For me, it's the Phoenix Lights. There was certainly something flying there. I just don't know what. Thanks, Brud. Cam, what is your answer to that?
Ooh, you want me to go first?
I'll go first.
You go first. Go for it.
My first, of course, if I could know one thing, the true story
behind...
I would have to say, everybody's probably guessing this, the Giants. The Giants of North America. I've read so many stories about it. I've read so many books about it. I've brought it up over the years numerous times. And you kind of alluded to it in one of the questions earlier. Is I would like to know if that is real. Are all these sightings that's reported in the Smithsonian and these newspapers and stuff, I'm sure some of them are fabrications, but there's always least hope for a few that are real. And even the one that in Sire, Pennsylvania, it's got horns.
Yes.
You hear these stories. I would like to know if the Giants were a real thing. What is yours?
Mine is, of course, you know, everybody's like, some people, you know, are probably screaming right now at the radio or whatnot because they want to know about Roswell or they want to know about that. My thing is the truth, complete and all, behind missing 411.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
I want to know where they're going, what's happened to those people, you know, what's causing it. I want to know all that. That's because to me, that's the one mystery that's just always weighing on the back of my mind.
Right. Yeah. That's a good one. Let's move on. This next one says, hey, fellas, here is my question for you both. If you were struck by some white lightning hoodoo like John Travolta in Phenomenon, but got to choose a superpower, what would it be and why? I would like the power of super knowledge, like an old John boy, but without having to die a short time later. I think that would be handy power to have, sort of like the Matrix download system deal. That would be mint. Hey guys, keep doing what you do. You're awesome and still my number one favorite podcast to listen to. I look forward to each and every episode and appreciate the hard work that goes into producing such a quality show twice a week. Respect, brothers. Dave Taylor from the top of the South Island in New Zealand. So, Cam, if you had a superpower, what would it be?
Well, thanks so much for that question, Dave. And it would play off of the last one. If I could pick a superpower, of course, I've talked about this, you know, and you get, but my thing would still be this. And it's because I've been listening to a lot of other podcasts of like true crime and missing people and things like that. I would like to be able to find or solve like the cold cases of missing and murdered people. And not just like that, not just find their remains or where they're at, but also find their killer or what took them to that. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. If somebody killed them, and you know, because I always think of the parents who have something have happened to their child and they spend 40 years and they never find any closure. The superpower that I would like to have was to be able to find either that child or that child's remains and give that family closure.
Man, you see, you are just such a better person than me. And that's a great answer. Mine is only useful to myself. My ability, and I wrote this down, now I feel terrible for even reading it compared to your answer. Yours is so noble.
What have you got?
I put down the
ability. Do you want a tail?
No. Oh. That's I put down the ability to know the outcome of sporting games in order to line my pockets.
Wow.
That's the only ability I want. The ability to know the outcome of sporting games in order to line my pockets.
Wow.
See?
Do you want wings or a tail? The ability to fly, that Christopher Walken question.
Yeah. But look, I was being completely honest. It would be handy. It'd be really handy to know the outcome of the next baseball game, the next Stanley Cup playoff game, the Kentucky Derby. All that stuff would be handy. Because...
Wow. I'm glad that we didn't tell each other all this. That's the greatest thing is when you start asking that, I'm like, I'm not telling you any of my answers. Geez, none of that stuff.
You're the one that comes out smelling like a rose with your whole noble wanting to solve crime. I'm just trying to get rich.
I'm obsessed with these podcasts of missing people.
No, you're right. Yeah.
And it drives, I can't imagine wrapping my head around that. And that's that one deal is I was like, man, I wished I could get involved, but I wished I had that special ability. Yeah, I can't help it, man. It just... I hate the you know what it is? It's just like I hate television shows or movies that are left unfinished too.
Yeah.
I like to have a little wrap up and closure in everything.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about our sponsors real quick before we get out of here. Don't forget, folks, Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. You can go over there to the video streaming service, check out all their titles. They're adding new ones over there every day. You can watch this on your phone. You can watch this on a tablet. You can watch it on a desktop. You can watch it on your television if you have Apple TV, Amazon Fire, Roku. You know the deal. It's a great, great service. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents and $9.95 after that. Also, Bloom That. Don't forget, Mother's Day is this week, folks. Sign up over there and you'll automatically get a free premium designer vase and caramel treats, a $25 value. Don't wait. This amazing offer only lasts this week and it's only available to our listeners if you go to bloomthat.com/expand. That's bloomthat.com/expand. If you have a sighting of your own, well, story or news or anything like that you'd like to share with the show, don't forget you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can also send us a Q&A with Cam and Kyle. If you want to ask us a question, make sure you put in the title line Q&A with Cam and Kyle and ask us a question and maybe be lucky enough to have your email chosen and read on the air. Also, if you want more Expanded Perspectives and you'd like to support what we're doing, you can go to Expanded Perspectives Elite. If you join Elite, you'll have an additional show every Friday as well as access to our entire back catalog. It's an incredible deal for only $5 a month. Just go to the website, expandedperspectives.com, click on the Elite tab. Signing up is easy. You just do it through PayPal, and you can set it up, and it'll automatically come out of your account once a month. I hope everybody has a really fantastic work week. Cam, what do you got planned for the rest of your week?
Well, my wife's going to be out of town, so she's got to go out for work. So it's just I'm going to be there with the girl child, so I don't know what will be going on. I imagine a little disc golf. I imagine a little yard work. You know, just the grind of going and doing. So that's pretty much about it.
You went to the movies this week. What did you see?
Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
How was that?
I loved it.
Really? I've never even seen the first one.
Oh, man, you've got to see the first one. The boys would love it. The boys would absolutely love it. It is funny. It's adventurous. I love it. I liked it as much or better than the first one. So, yeah, I'm a big Chris Pratt fan to start with. Yeah. You know, he's great. So, yeah, man, it was a great show. I had a great time.
Yeah, they have seen it. In fact, because Luke's always telling, is there a guy on there named Groot or something?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so I don't know what he's talking about because I haven't seen it, but he's
always talking about it. You need to watch it. You would enjoy it. You need to watch it.
I wonder if it's out on HBO or anything or Showtime or something.
I don't know. I don't know.
I recently watched on Showtime on HBO the other night the movie Sully, directed by Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, I haven't seen Tom Hanks. I think my wife and my daughter have seen it.
It's actually pretty good. Actually, it's pretty good. I had no idea that you know, once he did the landing, that the like FAA and everything was trying to come after him, trying to say like, you know, you could have returned it to the airport safely.
Yeah.
When they're missing the big point is who cares about the airplane? Not one person was injured.
Right.
All
exactly.
155 souls were saved. The Airbus that crashed, I mean, I know it cost a lot of money, but it's just a piece of metal, folks. At the end of the day, it's important that everybody survived.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good movie.
If exactly. As long as it saves people, I don't care what you do to the airplane. It can be replaced.
Exactly.
It's like, it's just trash. We're moving on.
I'm pretty
on.
Sure the thing was probably insured anyways, right? It's like your car.
Right. Exactly.
You know, if your daughter gets in a car wreck and totals the car and she's perfectly fine, are you going to be mad?
Yeah. No.
You're like, no. The important thing is you survived.
Laugh at it, throw it away, and go get another one.
That's right. Well, everybody have a great week. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.